Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke, and if the WWE ruined Shinsuke Nakamura by making him stop his spastic movements, calls him Michael Jackson, or have him working with Stardust, I will phone in a WrestleMania 7 star bomb threat to Cowboy Stadium. Then again, with Cena's injury, they might already be doing that themselves.
I'm G. John Chase. Already, this year's Royal Rumble looks to be better than last year, but that's not saying much. All I'm going to be hoping for is that this year I don't get another fucking aneurysm. Let's wait and see, folks. Let's wait and see.
I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and on our last show I said that WWE should sign AJ Styles, and lo and behold, this week they have. Was it another prophecy? Did WWE listen to everything I say? Or do I know someone on the inside? I'll let you decide that, folks.
And I'm Carl Jones, and it's a brand new year, everybody, but let's face it, at my age, what's the point in making New Year's resolutions when it's just an achievement to have made it through the night?
This is the panel for the 67th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about the scummiest moments in wrestling history next. And welcome to the 67th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke, alongside G. John Chase.
Star Wars was awesome.
Carl Jones.
It's 2016 already.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Absolutely.
Happy New Year, but from some positivity.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wanted to say Happy New Year to everybody that's listening right now. I hope you had a very good Christmas. Thank you very much for returning to us here in 2016. And what a fantastically upbeat and positive topic we have to talk about today, fellas, because we are going to be talking about the scummiest moments that the wrestling business has ever provided to us throughout the course of this podcast today. Of course, we went to you, the loyal listeners, for this topic and said, send us what you think are the best nominations for scummiest moment in wrestling history. And we have a cavalcade of notes here, 17 pages of feedback to talk about today. We're going to get to as many different nominations as we possibly can throughout the course of the show. We may have to do this in two parts because I want to give credence to everything. We're going to see how we do today. A little bit of housekeeping before we get rolling with the scummiest moments in wrestling history. Of course, if you listen to us for the first time, you can, of course, check out the archives at squaredcirclegazette.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes to make sure you never miss a show, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/scgradio. And I also want to give a very quick shout out and a thank you to the UK Fan Forum, who are currently doing their year-end awards, and we are in the final four for Best Podcast of 2015. So I want to thank everybody who's nominated us and voting for us, because right now it's us and the Steve Austin Show neck and neck, which is completely bizarre and surreal, but thank you very much, because it is very much appreciated.
I will say, given the state of Steve Austin's neck, that probably gives us a good chance.
touche. When I kind of envisioned this topic, and actually I want to give credit to WWF Chili from the UK Fan Forum, who sent this suggestion to us, things that were done on screen or off that were either done in poor judgment to try and draw money, garner interest, get somebody over, or just a general shitty thing to do. There's so many of these things. I'm going to kick off, first of all, with thoughts about Owen Hart. And Mad Dog from Pro Wrestling Only starts us off by saying, Vince continuing the pay-per-view after Owen fell to his death is the answer here. Lord of the Drums from F4W says, WWF continuing the show after the Owen incident is way up there for me too. Nick Davis on the Facebook page says, the death of Owen Hart and carrying on the show when one of the performers has died in the middle performing a stunt ordered by you is pretty low in my opinion. The show should have been stopped, and them sending people out when one of their good friends has just passed away is nothing short of disgraceful. Just shows the owner of the company is a cold hearted bastard with only his own agenda in mind. My question for you boys, would you have carried on the show? Maybe I'm in the minority, we shall see. Look forward to more shows over the next 12 months. Ian Drew Dice Clay from the UK Fan Forum also says, for me, the worst thing the WWF ever did during the Owen Hart situation wasn't the show going on. By far the most sickening thing was a week after the Owen Hart tribute show. The WWF aired footage of all their wrestlers showing up at the funeral with a big wreath of flowers after Martha Hart's lawyers asked them not to. They were so desperate to look like the White Knights that they completely ignored the request of the deceased to try and increase their public image. Not just that, they gave Jim Neidhart a job as a trainer to get the family on side. You don't hire the Anvil even as a window cleaner unless you have a motive behind it. So we'll answer Nick Davis's question there about whether or not we would have stopped the show before we delve into this, because I have a bit of a hard time kind of seeing this in the same light as some of the others we're going to talk about, which is why I wanted to get to this first today, because we're talking about scummy moments, things consciously done with bad intentions in mind, you know, the lowbrow route. And it's kind of funny because, as I was saying before, when we kind of envisioned this show, I thought that this was going to be kind of a humorous, uplifting, you know, all these funny little things that these crazy scumbag promoters do. And we may laugh at some point during the course of this podcast, but it's mostly going to be shock laughter at just how appalling some people can be. Mm. This one I find to be a little bit different from that category.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think the decision whether to stop the show is such a tough call for me. I mean, it's not like the usage of the Owens of the week after the funeral. That, yeah, that is, you know, that's deplorable.
Yeah.
That
to me is a better nomination for scummiest than the actual.
That is abusing someone's personal requests for your own gain, which for me that's scummy. Continuing a show, that's a real hard call because it's on the fly. You there's the shock factor. I have never had a problem without being in those shoes. It's such a tough call for me, and I've never held that against them, to be perfectly honest. I think it's time will just be completely distorted for everyone involved. You're making a call on the fly. Would I do it? I don't know. I mean, that's just, I can't even imagine being in that position. But I've never held that as a scummy moment myself.
Yeah, I mean, personally, like I agree with you. It's one that you can't really judge unless you're put into that situation yourself, unless you're in their shoes. In fairness, okay, if you play devil's advocate for the other side of things, well, if he decided to stop the show, well, what's the consequences of that? What's the play through on that?
The
what happens?
There? Yeah. You cancel the show, you send people home, you refund buy rates, you do the pay per view later on, something like that. Yeah, this isn't stuff that's completely implausible.
It's not implausible, but it's unlike the other stuff we'll come to. This isn't premeditated. This isn't a fluid situation. The show's still going on while a decision's being made. I'd have a problem with it if the boys who were coming up to wrestle voice their opinion and said, I don't want to go out there, and they were forced out there, so
pushed them out with a stick.
Yeah, but in my opinion, when it's a fluid situation and it's on, every second that goes by, the show's still going on. So at what point do you even make the decision to stop the show?
Because you've got so much going on.
Yeah, so what I mean, like, so 45 minutes later, then it's like, oh my god, now it settles, we make the decision, but then maybe you've got half an hour left. I think it's just a fluid situation. It's not premeditated like other scummy moments. So for me, I think it's a real tough, impossible situation to be put in. And to judge it retrospectively, I think, compared to other things we're going to come across, is harsh for me.
It's not like people at the time weren't saying this. Obviously, people were thinking, why didn't you stop the show? Because it was actually one of those things that I'd heard. Obviously, we all have our memories of how we heard the news, but in the old days of, you know, we were at school and, you know, gossip of what actually happens is usually always different to what happens. I actually was told they stopped the show, and then of course I found out they actually didn't, and I was a little bit confused myself as to why. I think, to me, more so than not doing that, again, it's the aftermath, the fallout of their explanations for why they didn't, that always annoy me. Things like them saying, well, the fans might riot and stuff like that. It's like, you don't need, you're covering your tracks now. There's probably completely genuine reasons why you didn't, because it's spur of the moment stuff. But when they try and cover their own tracks like that, it's, that's where it feels a little scummy.
Yeah, that's the crux of it, really. As Kieran said before, the real scummy nature to the Owen Hart tragedy is what follows it in the ensuing weeks with the wreath and you know, all that palaver,
with
if you
Davey
will.
Boy when they get him
yes,
back.
Yeah, all that sort of thing. That's the real sort of scrape in the barrel element to this. It's not something that's sort of personally got my back up when it comes to comparing it to other instances, largely because, as you say, it is fluid. I mean, I'd like to think retrospectively, if it was me, yes, I'd have cancelled the show. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. We have that benefit. They didn't have that at the time. And I think that's why a lot of people are so vociferous in their criticism of Vince when it comes to this sort of thing, because they look at it retrospectively and think, why didn't you cancel the show? And then you can look at the actions they did afterwards, and their sort of the company's own retrospective take on it paints them in an incredibly negative light. You know, sort of, and some people making remarks of, Owen would have wanted the show to go on. You know, comments like that just portray the company in such a negative light. And then when that happens, you sort of, you know, you naturally you put two and two together and possibly make five, don't you think? It's just scummy Vince, and he didn't want to lose out on the pay-per-view money. We can't objectively say that.
Well, in fact, also it's just I'm a bit unfamiliar with the exact moments of the chain of events. So when did they find out for absolutely certain that Owen had died? Because I don't think I keep hearing conflicting reports whether it was like straight away or whether it was like in the ambulance or when he arrived at hospital.
But my understanding is that the one thing we can say for certain is that he died a significant amount of time before the show finished.
Oh yeah, well, it wasn't even that when the medic, he's in Foley's book, isn't it? When Francois Petit comes through the curtain, he's saying he's gone, he's dead. I mean, I guess they had to wait for him to maybe go to the hospital and declare it, I don't know, but...
It would have been a lot worse if it was a situation where you are literally having to force the talent out through the curtain. Now, no one in that company, to the best of my knowledge, has come out and said that since. Anyone who was involved in the show, I think one or two have possibly said over time that they would have preferred the show had been cancelled, but as best as I can recall, there were no objections to going out there.
I'm sure I read somewhere where they're talking about Jarrett was like, they were pretty much in tears as he was kind of like walking out, and he was kind of like, you know, go on, like, it's your match, and he's just kind of like, he doesn't know what to do because he's just seen his friend just carted off, and he was just like, he was like, you know, trying not to like break down and stuff. So I don't know whether you'd consider that, you know, poking a stick in the back through the curtains or anything, or whether it's just the fact that because everything's so chaotic, nobody's really kind of connecting that to what's going on with the show, and they're just like continuing on and like
also quite
Everyone's mind is obviously going a mile a minute. I don't want it to seem like I'm equating it to the same sort of thing, but obviously he held up the company at No Mercy later that year. And please don't misconstrue this as me sort of making an apples-to-apples comparison by any means. All I'm trying to convey is that Jarrett's no shrinking violet. In the heat of the moment, yes, he goes out there. But he wouldn't be shy in voicing his opinion afterwards.
No, he's walked out on the company before for far less.
Exactly. So I think if he'd had any real objections going, you know, in future years, he would certainly have voiced them.
Crowbro from FOW certainly echoes that, says, it's hard for me to rank Owen above a lot of these because running the show is a heat-of-the-moment decision by those that had likely never been in that position. Most of the other stuff was calculated decisions that had to have passed through multiple channels to get okayed, and that's more insulting. KRZ151 from the FOW board, also on the subject of Owen, says, profiting off that Owen DVD, I think would be the top one for WWE. This is something that Meltzer was quite disgusted by on Observer Radio not too long ago. What's someone's thoughts on that? Not saying that all the money's going to the family and stuff like that.
It doesn't even need to all go to the family. It can go to a foundation, any sort of charitable source that you want. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with the notion of an Owen Hart DVD. Not because I don't necessarily think he deserved it, but I think I'm paraphrasing Meltzer a bit here. The reason he has a DVD is not about the quality of his work and what he contributed. It's got more to do with the circumstances of his death and being a tragic figure.
I have no problem with the DVD.
No?
Honestly. I mean, I don't know the details behind the finances of it, obviously, in terms of the merchandise and rights the family's getting. Obviously, you like to think, you know, they were suitably compensated, maybe above and beyond a traditional merchandising deal, but
I don't know if that's the case.
I don't know, yeah, but in principle, just release the DVD. If there's a market, that sounds bad. If there's a market for it, why not? There's DVDs for everything.
Most Scummy Podcast 2015. 16.
As a point of just the notion of having a DVD for Owen,
I've got no problem with that either.
I've got no problem with that per se. It's the I do have an issue with him or with the family. To the best of my knowledge, I don't think they're getting a penny from this. I don't think they're getting anything.
I think it's something.
Surely you got
that scum.
Unless there is a legal requirement, do you think Vince is giving them anything?
Trying to come from this from a neutral position, right? I disagree with you, Carl. I think Owen would have got a DVD anyway. Main just for the fact that it seems like almost anyone is getting a DVD these days. Anyone that had any kind of resemblance of a career or some sort of longevity in WWE anywhere near the top, as well as the top, would get something.
I don't see what the relevance is of he wouldn't have got a DVD if he hadn't died. He did die, so what's the? I don't understand what the problem with that is. Seeing as a copyright's entitlement to the estate,
royalties it's a standard thing they have to do. But yeah, I would assume so. But who knows? Moving on to hopefully a little bit more lighthearted than a couple of heavy things there. PSF from the UK fan forum says the Tori Wilson, Dawn Marie, Al Wilson angle comes straight to mind. Not only did we get a middle-aged man continuously getting naked with a much younger woman, including at their wedding ceremony, they killed him off whilst in the middle of a taped wedding night. He literally got shagged to death on TV, which is fine for Home and Away or Doctors or whatever is on in the afternoon these days, but for a wrestling show, no thank you. It was all very uncomfortable viewing, especially as me and my mate were watching whilst at Centre Parks, along with his mom and step dad. I would have much rather been caught reading American Grizzly with my pickle in my hand. The payoff, if I remember rightly, was a match between Tori and Dawn at the Rumble in a completely awful match that Dawn Marie completely dominated before Tori hits a neckbreaker for the pin. Yeah, that's comeuppance for you. Get your head kicked in, but at least you did one move. Did Tori and Dawn Marie also have a bit of a les off after this too, or am I getting confused with Sable? No, the les off was part of the hotel scene, wasn't it? Armageddon. Al Wilson.
The Tori Wilson Dawn Marie match at the Royal Rumble of 2003 was far more offensive than anything that went before it.
Are you sure?
I'm absolutely bloody certain. I was in tears.
I don't know, that wedding with Dawn and Al. I can't say this is the scummiest.
It's not scummiest. Is it horrible? Is it just shit TV and shit storylines? Absolutely. Is it offensive to my palate as a wrestling fan? Yeah. I'm tasting it, and it tastes like shit.
It would have been scummy if, during the feud,
Al actually died.
Actually died, and the story was she fucked him to death. That would be scummy.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I bet you a pound to a pinch of shit Al Wilson wasn't complaining.
Yeah.
more than fact, Tori Wilson was clearly so offended that she said she was open to the idea of working with her dad again in the company just months later.
How's that possible?
That would have been possible. Do you think like Steph was trying to tell Vince something with a storyline?
I have no idea.
Well, I'm assuming it might have been her that maybe pitched this to him, saying like, look, we got this old guy who's a bit of a lout, who's trying it on with some younger ladies, and maybe trying to, like, you know, just
subconsciously get the thing in. If you fuck with these women, Vince, you're gonna die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Vince's arms this week. Look at Carl. 70-year-old men have varicose veins, not bicep veins. It's ridiculous.
From one that's perhaps not the scummiest thing ever to one that's pretty high on the list, one of my personal favourites, Carl, if you can call it that, DNJ from Pro Wrestling Only says, I wasn't a fan at the time and don't know much about the WWE Confidential programme, but didn't the WWE air the Lex Luger Miss Elizabeth 911 call? I don't even know what the context of that was, and I don't care how newsworthy it is. Airing it just seems really classless to me.
What the fuck?
Oh, it was awful. That it was fucking awful. He pretty much just, I said it before, they put the gun in Luger's hand is what they pretty much did here. It was horrible. Like, what do you say about a company that is so pissed off with a wrestler that they'll do this?
Yeah, this is what you did to us in the fall of 95. Yeah,
you walked out in our company, so we're gonna make you look like a murderer.
It wasn't enough just to play it either, as if that wasn't bad. They put the words on the screen.
Oh yeah,
as you tend to see on these on news items, they have the 911 calls. You know, all that palaver. Hogan talking about and one or two others as well, talking about how in WCW, you know, she wasn't protected. There was this whole sense of not just, you know, this is a horrible death in which someone's overdosed. Luger killed her. Oh, and by the way, for years she was basically, you know, used and abused in WCW. That's generally the impression I get.
Oh, yeah.
She wasn't protected. You know, you didn't have the protective family that she had in the WWF.
That protective family
being Randy Savage's locker room.
Being locked in a fucking closet.
And Savage only having the key.
It just makes me laugh just hearing just Hulk Hogan being like a talking head on these kind
of
things.
Oh, he's an arsehole.
Because he's a bastion of morality,
yeah,
isn't he now?
Yeah. F-Bomb and Co. from F4W says, won't top the list by any means, but WWE showing footage of a temporarily dead Jerry Lawler in a video package before his return, and CM Punk interrupting his emotional comeback speech. Totally unnecessary, and it's not like a great talker like Punk needed that to generate heat. John Carr, 92 from the UK fan forum, also said, CM Punk mocking Jerry Lawler's near-fatal heart attack on Raw was very uncomfortable to watch. WWE were highly praised for their handling of the situation. Michael Cole going as far as to switch the mics off after he fell out of his chair, so the audience at home couldn't hear him groaning in agony. I will never forget seeing this one photo from a fan of Cole at the announce table sobbing his eyes out. It was one of the saddest things I've ever seen. But stuff like Punk saying, you're lucky you had a heart attack because I would have beaten you to death. And Paul Heyman collapsing with Punk imitating CPR until Paul popped up laughing, pissed it all away. Completely unnecessary. That was very chilling when they played that. It was almost like the, like, you know, like on a pay-per-view when you play like the hype of the angle before Lawler's comeback speech, and they showed the footage of him on the stretcher with him putting the defibrillators on Lawler. That was horrible. That was chilling to watch. Like, you're looking at a dead guy. It's horrible.
It was just like more like one of the shows you get like 999 or 911 to Americans, whatever. This video package of like the slick WWE style that they have now, just intercut with this very kind of real moment where they don't have the proper audio anyway, so they've got to put the subtitles up. I don't think it's necessarily offensive to me, because I don't know, I'm guessing they
passed it through Jerry Lawler first. And
well,
Lawler,
this is what I was
and Lawler just kind of
yeah.
went like, yeah, all right
yeah.
then.
But Lawler is like the last person in the world to say, Jerry, are you okay with this? Because he's going to say yes every time.
Well, yeah, it's less about like being like offended by it. It's more just like, it didn't need to be done. Full stop. It's just like, I mean, yeah, have him return and like, have the round of applause from the audience and so on. Let him retire.
See, you're expressing this all, Gene, a very, you know, comforting manner. You're trying to be nice and polite and civil. Let's be honest. You can dress it up however you want. You know, the way you're implying it here isn't what you really feel, is it? Admit it. You thought, he's gone. Now's the chance to have him never appear on TV again.
First of all, Jerry would fucking love the attention.
Of course he does.
He survived, so it's a happy story. I think if you're going to mention it and you've got the footage, show it. People want to see it. People were, you know, people cared.
All of that, what you just said, if they're going to do that, and sure, that's distasteful in some ways, scummy perhaps, who knows, it's subjective anyway, but the whole idea of doing all that to generate that emotion and hit the heartstrings so that when Cult of Personality kicks in, which and Punk comes sauntering out, it's like, that's okay, that would have been enough. Paul Heyman pretending
recreation.
Paul Heyman fucking clutching his chest, falling over, Punk doing the X and then saying, for God's sakes, Paul, you almost gave me a heart attack.
Well, CM Punk's a classless guy, can we say?
And I'm going to play devil's advocate here, because I know what the response would be, but let's say, so all that's okay. How do you have felt if Lawler had actually died, and then they showed that footage afterwards?
Completely different situation. They couldn't do that, they wouldn't do that.
As bad as this company can be, at the best of times...
Including sticking the fucking camera on this guy. Yeah. That, to me, is like the thing that felt sleazy at the time.
That's the thing, as uncomfortable as it seems, and there are people that want to see it. In answer to your question, G, if Jerry Lawler had died, as bad as this company can be at the best of times, I honestly don't think we'd have ever seen any footage.
It would have
been a more standard, if you like, sort of heartfelt tribute, 10-bell salute, you know, talking heads giving their thoughts.
I still think it's a fine line, though, of just like, if he died, it's not cool to show that footage.
It's not a fine line at all. It's the line between life and death.
No. If he died, it wouldn't have been cool to show that footage, but because he survived, it's okay.
Yeah.
I still don't think it is okay.
But gee, Lawler agreed to all this.
We think.
Probably.
Of course he did. For God's sake, he quit the promotion in 2001 because they fired his wife. Do you think if he'd really been upset by this, he would have gone through with it?
Yeah,
of course he wouldn't have.
The Colsef, when Denise suggests using the death of Lawler's mom.
Mentioning that right now. Undefeated stake. Undefeated stake on the UK fan forum says, another that sprung immediately to mind was Michael Cole taking the piss out of Jerry Lawler's recently deceased mother, more so because of how little it was ever going to achieve. Certainly one of those moments where you question what the fuck you're watching.
Lawler's come, and the same with the heart attack stuff, Lawler's coming from this with a different perspective. He's coming from it as a 40-year main eventer with hands in promotion. It's about him personally. And he was obviously able to separate the reality of the situation to him to what the business boost it would give his friend Michael Cole. And if he was happy to do it, and if it was even his idea, as I believe was the case, who are the rest of us to judge, I don't think.
And of course he gets a Mania payday out of it.
Oh, of course, yeah, exactly.
he's obviously, you know, I don't want to say he's got loose morals or anything, but he's obviously not... Much like the heart attack stuff, uncomfortable for me to watch personally. Do I like it? No, but Lawler's agreed to it, so I can't stand on or sit on my perch forever and gripe about it.
Moving on here to another of wrestling's scummiest moments. Sai Rai from the UK fan forum says, the Tim White suicide attempts. As if the idea wasn't distasteful enough, the first sketch aired not long after Eddie Guerrero's death, if I recall correctly. And as if that wasn't bad enough, it then continued for weeks, with White trying different ways to kill himself because his life had been ruined due to the injuries he suffered in the Jericho Triple H Hell in a Cell match. The videos of the man trying to kill himself due to a deep depression even got a catchy title on WWE.com, Lunchtime Suicide. Because what a great thing to joke about. This was, I remember they did the first one at Armageddon when they had the shotgun. Remember that? Like, Tim White's at the bar and Josh Matthews interviewing him and he walks off camera, despondent, and then shoots himself. And then Juventud Guerrero has to go to the ring on his fucking one day to do a Cruiserweight title match right after.
That's the thing, because you mentioned the first one where he was almost sort of manic depressive. And then as the skits went on, and if I'm not mistaken, didn't it eventually just become sort of an exclusive WWE.com?
Yeah, after the
videos,
first one.
Yeah, after the first one.
Thank God.
By which point he was almost like the sort of crazy professor smiling maniacally as they went on. It sort of, you know, there was no attempt to portray it in any serious manner. How the hell could you? He keeps coming back to life, it would seem, every week. It you'd probably look at it as scummy in relation to the timeline if it ties in with the Guerrero stuff. So in that sense, yeah, it's probably a bit, when you've had a wrestler, you know, die under contract and you do these things, however almost, you know, in inverted commas, light-hearted you try to make it, it's a bit tasteless. But again, much like some of the other ones, I think we'll come to far worse as the podcast progresses.
Obviously, try to portray it in a light-hearted way, but what's the fucking point of having this on a wrestling show? You know, like a Russo miscarriage angle. It's a subject matter that a lot of the audience could take offence at for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to build up the danger of Hell in a Cell later that night, of course.
What's the point? And it's just why offend people on such a serious subject matter, particularly when your biggest demographic is the highest, you know, age group prone to suicides, young adults. Yeah, classless for no reason whatsoever. No matter what, how you try and portray it as in a funny light, it's like, why do it?
When you make it sound like, you know, like the way they're trying to sell the Hell in the Cell, you know, it's like, two men will enter, you know, only one man will leave, you know, one man will die, and if you survive, you want to kill yourself. Well, that's Hell in the Cell. You know,
that's
like,
the stupid thing. They already had stock footage of Tim White in a very serious manner hyping the Hell in the Cell. I don't know if everyone around the table's seen it as part of the No Mercy build for the Lesnar take on in 2003. You know, they had the sort of the talking head bit, and they had Tim White on there, and it showed you the incident where he gets knocked into the cell and takes that nasty spill, and it was, you know, very melancholy. You know, he was head down. He was, don't ever put me anywhere near that cell again. And, you know, that in a sense, that worked.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to say it added X amount of buys to the paper or anything, but, you know, it you know, it's a good piece of, you know, sort of side salad, if you like, to the main course.
Business.
Yeah. You know, so when you've got that, if it was really any intention of trying to hype up the cell match, sweet Jesus, there's no hope.
This is the scummy element to me, is that they've got a guy who they want to keep on the payroll, but they won't just keep him on the payroll. You've got to earn it, god damn it.
Yeah.
A la Vicky Guerrero.
We're more on her later.
Exactly.
As I said with the Melanie a while ago, it's just like, hey, you sign a contract, someone's fucking doing the job.
Someone's doing the work.
Someone's getting their shoulders pinned.
More on her later as well. Cobra 1000 on the UK fan forum says, can I say Virgil? Has anyone said Virgil yet? Maybe not.
Boy's birth.
Maybe not the scummiest, but potentially the most racist. I don't know whether it's exploitation or just plain ignorance, or there was a maliciousness to it that went beyond ribbing Dusty Rhodes. As much as Virgil and Ted DiBiase were a staple of my childhood, you can look back and see that this isn't right. Obviously, being seven, you don't know what racism is or the connotations of certain things. I do think certain things can be played on within wrestling. Perhaps stereotypes can be played with, but blatant racism? No. In the opening vignette, the Million Dollar Man says he owns, yes, owns Virgil. Yes, sir. DiBiase bought and conned many people, but Virgil was his slave, and that was what was implied. I think I can just stop there.
I must admit, growing up, much like the emailer watching it, a lot of that was lost on me, to be honest.
Oh, it's totally lost on me.
Yeah, you know, to me, it's just the... Here's his sort of right-hand man, if you like, who's getting paid to sort of throw his body in the way and protect DiBiase in many respects. I never saw much beyond that. And you can go back and
Virgil the toes.
And yeah. And you can go back now and you think, God, if I was, you know, 20 or 30 at the time, then maybe it would have had more of an impact on me. But I think it was all lost on me at the time. It's hard for me to look back and, I think, put it in its proper context, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, if you know, I had no inkling about the fucking war, whatever, in 91, if I didn't give a shit about that, then I'm sure as hell didn't know fucking anything about the fucking slave trade back when I was a kid. Yeah, no, I mean, as a...
Virgil!
As a kid...
Patterson never allowed that.
I mean, there you go, there's a shot.
There you go, first one of 2016. I'm trying to see the best in Vince on this one.
Oh, don't do that.
I know that I feel like a little sick in my mouth already, but Did he just kind of look like he was thinking like, right, I got Ted DiBiase and we're going to do something where he's going to have like a manservant, right? We need to cast someone, and it just so happens the best person for the role he thought just turned out to be black, or did he just find, or did he just say to, you know, Pat Patterson, whatever, find me a black person now to do this role? Where did that come about? Because I never,
just because we were naive to the connotations of the angle, don't for one second think they were. They knew full well.
Deliberately playing off.
Well,
it's not. I don't see it as him belittling a black guy. I just see it more like he's belittling a guy. He's just making a guy his manservant, and it's not for me
again,
now. It's not quite. It's not quite about the skin.
It's funny how that it contrasts. Whereas to me, it obviously, it sort of watching back now, I feel like it's slapping me in the face.
Yes.
And obviously, when you look in a wider context at the unedifying history of racism in the wrestling business. You know, DiBiase with Savio Vega back in 96.
Oh, yeah.
The strap match. Old chauffeur boy, I've got your hat. Harley Race and Ron Simmons in 91.
More on that later.
okay then. So which one's worse then? Virgil's treatment by Ted DiBiase, or Kane and Cole with Colonel Parker? Which one's racially worse?
We didn't get to see what I believe was the brainchild of Sid Vicious, where they actually were.
As if you're going to listen to that, Bella.
Well, apparently they almost did for one day, where they had him in chains as like ex-cons or whatever. They were just a tag team with a rich Southern guy. To me, I never saw it, Kane and Cole that way particularly.
Kane and Cole, the names.
Well,
it's a bit more on the nose,
but
isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not quite a fair comparison in some respects, in the way that, with Rob Parker, you've got the Weasley manager, and Booker T and Steve Ray are the two badasses.
Yeah,
you know, you never saw him belittling them on screen. It was more just a standard manager wrestler relationship.
Just to move on here as well, Kobe 1000 also says, I'll probably give a nod to Jesse Ventura too, and his continuous JBL-like hatred of Chico Santana. I bet Chico wishes he was back home selling tacos in Tijuana right now, in quotes. Was Lon Heenan said that time, about how he's like a cue ball, because the harder you strike, the more English you get out of him?
Something like that, and remember...
oh, God!
What was it? What does Ariba mean? Swim for the border?
Swim faster, the border guards are coming, yeah? Move along now to one that obviously got a hell of a lot of votes, and it may actually have been the most voted one. Steve Bochenik on the Facebook page says, I will go with the interview of Brian Pillman's widow the day following the death. Kieran Swain from the Facebook page says, it simply has got to be the interview with Brian Pillman's widow. Honestly, Vince is and always has been a soulless, egotistical piece of shit who would sell his own family if it was best for business. But this is by far the worst thing he's done. Forget Montreal. Disregard Vince wrestling garden going over. You can even disregard the fact he put Triple H in a position of power, a heinous act in itself. But this is by far the most offensive, scummy thing to happen in wrestling. Christopher Jones, also on the Facebook page, says, as soon as I read the topic, the first thing that came to mind was that interview. Vince asking her how she's going to support the family, such a dick thing to do. Baz, TNM number one from the UK fan forum, says, have to agree with the Melanie Pillman interview. You can't go much lower than that. Matt Applin on the Facebook page says, great discussion topic, lads. This could turn into a whole series of podcasts when you look back historically at every scumbag moment in wrestling, which I think is what we're going to do. However, I am going to go on a limb and predict the Melanie Pillman interview may get the most feedback. In my opinion, it wasn't the fact that they interviewed her, it was the questions that were asked, such as, what are you going to do to support for your family? What a low life. If the interview had been designed to provide a feel-good retrospective of his life, it may be viewed in a different light. But hey, thank goodness this would be the only time death was exploited. Oh, damn it, Vince. Air Jordan fan 93 from the F4W board says again, it's this one. A woman who's just lost her husband and McMahon decides to interview her as a ratings ploy. I know McMahon has done a lot of fucked up things during his career, but this one still takes the gold medal for scummiest move. MIM from the UK fan forum says, it felt like a total ratings ploy and massively exploitative. The interview was actually quite distressing and Melanie seems understandably distraught. The whole thing feels grubby and ugly, not to mention desperate. Smelly Meatball from the TPWW forum says, Vince's interview with Pillman's wife, done both for a ratings ploy and I think to get the wife to publicly say that WWF nor wrestling had any role in his death. Air Raid from the UK fan forum also chimes in on this one and says, I rank this far higher than the other exploitation of someone's death. There are two reasons, one being that it comes so immediately after the tragedy of Brian's death. Everything is so raw and it so shamelessly exploits a woman not in the industry that in no way whatsoever would have been in the right state of mind to know what she was doing. Moreover, you can even slightly understand, warped as it is, the use of the references to Eddie and of Paul Bearer's characters in association with The Undertaker to try and add something to the storylines in question. Disgusting as it was, these were both designed to try and add something extra to a storyline leading to a pro wrestling match or matches on a pay-per-view, so it can be justified, if that isn't too strong a word, as exploiting somebody's death to try and profit indirectly. Just wrestling being low rent as it has always been and always will be. In contrast, putting the Widow of Pillman on live TV 24 hours later, I despair. Were they that desperate to try and beat Nitro that they thought a grieving Widow would have more wrestling fans tune in than the bill for Hogan and Piper at Halloween Havoc? Maybe, but I don't see the logic. I generally think that Vince was crossing everything that Melanie would have had something positive to say about the company, and his line of questioning about drug use was almost designed to try and give her a chance to say that whatever Brian was doing, it wasn't the WWF's fault or to their knowledge. In some twisted way, they were trying to share in her grief and show the viewers that they cared, that they felt the pain of losing one of their own. And yeah, let's try and be subtle, it wasn't our fault! Shower of bastards. This was the one that I think got more nominations around the table on the Christmas show, Pillman's wife.
To try and figure out the mind of Vince McMahon, I'm trying to figure out under what basis would he think this is a good idea? Was this Vince trying to be edgy? Like him realizing he's having to compete with WCW and this feel like, oh, we got to go to an edgier product. Is this Vince, in his simplistic mind, him completely misinterpreting what edgy means? And goes with this because there was nothing else really before it.
Oh, there were, to this extent. But it's not the same thing as what they're trying to put in storylines in that sense. There'd been things like the Pillman Files, which were innuendo laced. Even in '96, you'd had the Shawn Michaels, Diana Smith storyline, which had its tasteless moments.
Ahmed joining the Nation and the racial evidence. There was a lot of stuff going on at that time. We've talked about the Monday Night War timelines that you can listen to at squarecirclegazette.com.
What I would say is, G, it's not Vince's attempt to try and be edgy, this interview with Melanie Pillman. It's a couple of things. Again, part of the frantic nature, and I'm not using this to defend him, it's the frantic nature of the war and a sort of a desperation to be willing to almost do anything from a ratings perspective. I'm sure that probably crossed his mind. And as one of the emailers referenced in a much more articulate way than I can probably manage, it was almost a way of doing damage limitation as well. Those are the two things. And I think to compare this to, say, the Owen Hart issue that we started the podcast with, this to me really is what, when you think scummiest moments, this is up there, because you can't use the sort of the fluidity of the event itself. I don't think, as much as emotions may still be raw, you've still at least had 24 hours to digest what has happened with Pillman. You've then had to sort of calculatedly go out of your way to contact Melanie, to get a satellite link set up, to get cameras in there. You know, that's all. There are so many processes you would go through in order to present what they did that night, where you could stop at any moment and think, no, it's best we don't do this. So it's a much, much colder outlook, I think, from Vince in this respect. And for me, on that basis alone, if we come to a scummier one, I'd be surprised.
The reason why I put this higher than anything else, and why I'm trying to get into what the mindset of Vince was, and he's now turned around and thought, like, well, let's use this then. Let's use this as well and turn it into a storyline. It's like, where does the mindset go into thinking that?
It's completely exploitation of a tragedy, but you raise the question of, is it Vince's attempt to be edgy? Which is why I said no and referenced storylines where he'd attempted to be edgy. In no way am I suggesting this compares directly to the storylines in any way whatsoever.
This would be my number one, and it's a number of reasons. One, it's totally exploitative of a non-wrestling personality.
Yeah.
The goal of it was surely damage limitation, but on top of that, the way it's hyped throughout the show.
Yeah. When we did this on the Monday Night War timeline, that's the thing that you said specifically.
You know, I think a lot of times we may jump to conclusions that it was used as a ratings ploy. The way this was built throughout the show, there is no other way to interpret it, in my opinion. And for those different elements, I think this is probably on a different level to everything else. It's just, there is no, it's not even, I mean, and using a death as a storyline crutch is not an excuse, as we'll come to, but it's not even that. It is purely company damage limitation, and with the added bonus of, let's hype the shit out of this for a rating, and it's
coming up next.
And then you throw in the exploitive nature of this innocent woman who's
her mind is completely fried after 24, 48 hours of chaos in her life.
That fucking close up on her face.
Terrible stuff.
And the inside shots of the house, but you mentioned that the hyping it before, and you know I think there was even one where they zoomed in on a picture of Austin and Pillman as the Hollywood blondes, and it's all just that's what sort of makes you
fucking horrible.
It's just
completely scummy.
It's just sickening.
What was she doing, really? I mean,
it's nothing. She's grieving.
Her husband just died. She's not thinking of anything.
Yeah, I know she's grieving, but it's just kind of like I don't know what would have been said to her.
Do you want to come on TV and talk about it?
Do you grieve? Then fucking grieve. Yeah, please do. But what would have made her go I'll do it on TV for you.
Maybe to your husband. Yeah, and work.
Maybe she thought it could have been therapeutic. Maybe it could have been cathartic for her. Maybe that was what she thought.
In the 24 hours after a loved one so close to you dies, who's to say what's rational and what's not? Yeah. Because how the fuck do we know? We're not in that position. We're not Melanie Pillman. No. So I'm not going to pass judgment on anything she does, because her husband just fucking died and left her with five kids. Mm. So I don't see how anybody can try and put themselves in her position here, because none of us can relate to that in the slightest little bit. And again, that reality, to me, is what makes this so fucking horrible.
Yeah.
Because we know that we can't imagine what that's like. Yeah. And Vince doesn't think the same way we're thinking. He's thinking, coming up next!
Yeah. That's what I'm getting at.
I don't mean to laugh, but it's just the absurdity of it.
That's what I'm saying.
A couple of more humorous ones here after a very serious discussion there. Fignuts HD Edition from TPWW Forum says, Bret Hart writing in his book about all the women he cheated on his wife with while she was at home raising the kids and trying to act like a victim and gain sympathy for it. Not just the scummiest thing in wrestling history.
If Shawn Michaels had done that, it would have been the scummiest thing in wrestling history. That's all I'm saying.
I just thought he was being marvellously honest.
Yeah. Brought tears to my eyes. Supreme BVE from Pro Wrestling Only said the scummiest thing in wrestling history is Jay Roberts' entire life. And then he follows it up by saying, also, didn't Brock Lesnar throw a one-legged man down a flight of stairs?
That was great.
That was hilarious.
That's heat.
I hate to admit this, but that's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Yeah. Zach Gowan's short run was incredibly fun, and Suplex Sinner from the UK Fan Forum also said this one. Awful to watch at the time, watched it a few days ago again, and the absolute beating he gave a disabled person, albeit one who wrestled professionally, was and still is horrendous. The fact he was only 19 or so at the time makes me wonder if there was a bit of naivety on his part, but it is shocking to watch. This, I'm referring to, obviously if you haven't seen it, the fantastic squash match when the real Brock Lesnar F5 Zach Gowan's one leg into the ring post twice and busts him over with a horrible chair shot when he's on the floor, bloodies him up right in front of his own mom, and it's an absolute massacre, but I thought it was great.
Oh, it's fucking awesome.
And in fairness, I'm sure however horrible it might have been for poor Zach Gowan at the time, I'm sure he kind of benefited at least in the short term of that financially.
The thing is, you can say it's distasteful because he's disabled, but that's why he had a job, and he was fully on board with that, and it's what he wanted, so I have no problem with that whatsoever.
They'd done, in terms of the treatment of Zach Gowan, I think they'd done things prior to that were more distasteful, if I want to say. Vince kicking the fake leg out during the arm wrestling contest.
That was tasteful. That was funny.
Or I don't know if you remember the skit with Sable, the older, you're not even a real man, you're an amputee.
Yeah, that's a little thick.
I think I personally find more distasteful than a wrestling angle where a monster beats down someone who's much weaker and takes advantage of him.
Monster.
Vince Verhey from the F4W board says, hey. 3-minute warning given a very violent beating to two skinny women in bikinis who've been bought out as sex objects made me physically ill. Remember this is the HLA angle that Bischoff did on a Raw in 2002, and of course 3-minute warning come out, and I mean legitimately I think Jamal broke the woman's ribs right with the sidekick, then Sky edited this off. They beat the fuck out of him.
I was going to say that they edited this one off, and didn't they edit off the same one with Lillian Garcia as well?
Was it Lillian or was it Muller and May? I didn't think they attacked Lillian, did they? Or did they?
They did. I thought they did attack Lillian, because it wasn't a major storyline or anything, but didn't Finkel push Lillian in front of him or something and bailed?
Yeah, during the very short heel turn of Howard Finkel.
Yeah. So I think that there's a couple of times where 3-minute warning did this, and it didn't air over this side of the pond.
But one thing that did was that time they beat up the midget Goldust, where they gave him like a leg and a wing, threw him really high in the air, and just slammed him down as hard as they could.
Is that the same one where the midget Goldust trying to hop the rail to get away and can't?
I can't remember. We come now to the section that I've titled the Fritz Von Erich Memorial Parade of Horseshit, because there's a lot of things that Fritz Von Erich did, and he got a lot mentioned as the king scumbag. Vastard Archive. Oh, go on, Carl.
And they're all for sale in 8x10s.
Oh, well, here we go, Carl, you're jumping the gun. Vastard Archive from TPWW says, this is going to be difficult. That said, I'm going to go with a Fritz Von Erich heart attack angle in World Class. DJ Convoy says the same thing. Faking a heart attack to bring the gate up. El Macal from Pro Wrestling Only says, the first thing I think of when I think of scummy Fritz Von Erich is when he faked a heart attack in the ring a couple of years after David's death. LCC from the UK Fanform says, this heart attack angle is the worst for me. Using people's concern for his health to make a bit more cash is scummy, but the fact they deliberately played off his previous family tragedies is fucking disgusting. This happened after David's overdose in Japan and Mike's toxic shock, then suicide, which just made the exploitation of tragedy even harder to stomach. Mike Campbell from Pro Wrestling Only says, when the heart attack angle does come up on the show, you should at least mention the fact that Kevin Von Erich has adamantly denied for years now that they never planned for the angle to go that way. They were just supposed to attack Fritz to add more heat to the latest redux of the Freebirds Von Erichs feud, but when Fritz collapsed, the fans just jumped to that conclusion and it blew up. Like anything Kevin Von Erich says. He's that guy.
That's it. We've only got Kevin's word to take on that one, frankly.
Consider the source.
Yeah. I can understand why the emails there go to the heart attack angle, because of the way it plays off the previous real life tragedies.
Yeah.
So I can understand why they went to that one. But for me personally, it was always the Mike Von Erich suicide. You know, they'd had the note. They knew he was dead. And they're still going along with promoting the shows. And it's a difficult one to explain, because it's one of those that I've always found the more distasteful, the way it was sort of business as usual coming from the company when they know what's happened.
Yeah.
And they're sort of keeping everyone in the dark for the purposes of projecting a better image for the company, if that makes sense.
Well, there's more on Fritz here. We're talking about the heart attack here specifically just because, obviously, the whole idea of... And it was so blatantly, obviously, preying on the concerns for family and family tragedy and stuff like that, trying to get in the papers to try and bring up the gate, as one of the contributors said there. Smack2K from Pro Wrestling Only says, how about helping convince a clearly brain-damaged and fragile Mike Von Erich to get back in the ring quickly after toxic shock in 85, when anyone watching knows that kid should have been nowhere near it after his incident? This is the living miracle phase of Mike Von Erich's career and life, unfortunately, which is, again, just horrible. Just wheel out another CEO. Doesn't matter that he's clearly not the same, just keep sending him out there.
The press conference itself is bad enough, isn't it? You just,
he looks so frail. It's horrible.
He's frail, he's gaunt. It's almost like the lights are on but no one's home. His speech is slurred, and it's all just really uncomfortable to watch. And then obviously everything that follows on from it just makes those images themselves a million times worse.
Over at Pro Wrestling Only, they had a bit of a Fritz off when we were talking about Fritz Von Erich. Jerry Von Kramer says, the thing with Fritz trying to get that Chris Adams blinding angle over is he was dealing with the death of Gino Hernandez. I don't know if you remember this, but obviously we didn't see this live, I've watched this in retrospect. The show when Gino Hernandez is announced as dead and they're talking about him, they'd just done an angle right before where Gino Hernandez had blinded Chris Adams, and they actually announced this on the show, the death of Gino Hernandez, as a dual tragedy. The death of Gino and the blinding of Chris. They actually tried to do it within the same context as each other, as if this was the end of both men's careers. Putting equal weight on these two completely disparate things, one real, one not. And it's just, the guy's really dead. The guy is really dead. And you, again, just that thing of, gotta get the angle over, gotta keep up business as usual, like you said. That's the chilling thing about all of this stuff with Fritz. And again, there is more, unfortunately. Infinite from Pro Wrestling, and he says, didn't Fritz forge autographed pictures after David died? Alluding to what you said there, Carl. Crap Game 13 from F4W says, doubling the price of David Von Erich's autograph after his death and having Chris, Mike and David Manning sign more stuff in David's name to generate the money.
Yeah, it's like you get the impression Fritz regrets not having more kids so they could kill themselves or die.
I don't know about this.
That's just disgusting.
Yeah, it's disgusting. And I see what you mean in the sense of, if he doesn't have a heart about this, then, because, I mean, it's his own sons. It's not even just, it's not wrestlers on the show. It's his own sons. That's just fucking low.
Do you think that the reason he thought he could do this was because it was his sons? I'm trying to get into like what his thought process is,
because he's
is, like,
trying to make money off the death of his son. That's all
I'm
it
trying
is.
To think, like, simple the as reason that. Why, because the deplorable thing is that it's his sons. You think of the reason why he did it was because it was his sons, and he thought, like, well, they're my sons, so I can do with them what I want.
Maybe in all honesty, I doubt his thoughts were that deep on the matter, to be honest. I think it's much more in line with what Kieran has said. It's just he's, you know, he's from the old school, if you like, old school promoter. He says there's money to be made here, let's make it.
And the Gino treatment as well. It doesn't matter if it's his son or not. He'd get away with it more. That's probably the difference.
Yeah.
But it's fucking.
It shows his character traits, doesn't it? Because he does it to just some other person as well. So, but you lose that footing then if you're Fritz, aren't you? To say, well, it's my family. You know, if anyone can do it, I've got the right to do it. As you know, when you then go and do it with Gino anyway. You sort of throw that argument back in people's faces.
Well, yeah,
or that logic back in people's faces.
Yeah, I mean, the Gino thing, it is awful, but I, you know, in terms of like trying to compare something that's real to something that's fake, but I still think that the kids, what he does with the kids is a whole lot many levels higher than that. I mean, as you were saying, like dragging a kid out when he was beyond being allowed in the ring, forging another son's signature to get money off their back. I think there's like levels to scumminess, and that's even more so.
The only difference is he could get away with it because it's his family. That's if you know, he'd probably, you know, looking at a lawsuit off Gino's family if he's he's forging his autographs, but that's irrelevant. Eventually, it's just what you can get away with as a promoter. That's the difference.
And that's exactly what I was looking for. It's just because in terms of why he would do it, and he kind of mentioned it there, he probably thought he could get away with it because it's his son, because he knows no one's going to freaking sue him over it. He can do what he wants. It's his kids.
Chasing Amy Matt from Wrestling Forum says the way in which they handled the deaths of the Von Erich boys does leave a horrible taste in my mouth. And the single they recorded, I remember that Heaven Needed a Champion thing for David.
God, yeah. And all the Yellow Rose of Texas stuff.
And Fritz faking a heart attack. I mean, why not fake a heart attack with all the other genuine tragedy in that family? Paul Siebert from the F4W board talks about three promoters that we'll get to over the course of these podcasts. Talking about Fritz here and his scummy ways as a promoter, trying to cover up David's death by claiming it had nothing to do with drugs and that it was due to injury sustained from an anonymous Japanese wrestler who David still beat.
It was gastroenteritis, Liam.
Yeah. It was even on the death certificate. Not that those things can be fudged.
Are you questioning the arguments of one Wild Bill Irwin? Are you suggesting he's not a credible source?
Paulsy, but also in addition to the things we've just mentioned before, says adding Mike's name to the annual Parade of Champions David Von Erich tribute show, because why not use two dead sons to sell a supercard? After Kevin Von Erich's near fatal seizure in the ring, he uses it as an opportunity to get over Brian Adias's new devastating finish, the Oriental Tool Punch.
It punches him in the dick.
Tool Punch. Hiya! I don't know about that. That's pretty. And he mentions everything that we've talked about there, but that's. Sums up Fritz quite nicely.
I stand by my initial statement. I'm sure he wished he had more stuns to sell memorial shows.
Well, unfortunately, the argument in favour of that is the fact that he did make a fake Von Erich in Lance Von Erich. So, there you go.
That last one I was completely unaware of.
Yeah.
Kevin had a seizure in the...
And they turned it into an angle to get over a new finishing move. The look on Carl's face, ladies and gentlemen. And think of all the things he said over the course of the last 66 podcasts. Bill Diarrhea from the UK Fan Forum says Puppet the Midget Killer wanking off in a bin in TNA was weird and hardly guaranteed to draw any money. Not sure about the scummiest moment in the history of wrestling, but
disgusting, absolutely.
Certainly low brow, I'll give you that.
Who wrote that?
Bill Diarrhea.
No, the angle.
I'll have one guess.
Okay.
Yeah. The Clint from the UK Fan Forum says that stuff with Big Boss Man and the Big Show was awful too, with those funeral scenes and Boss Man cutting promos trying to make fun of someone that had died of cancer, just another one of many tasteless storylines. Carl's laughing. I guess we can chuckle at this one a little bit easier just based on the fact that there was no real death, there was no real cancer death here, and they weren't exploiting anything real, it was all fictional. Still, it was so hokey, it just sucked.
You almost feel like you played
Al
semantics.
Wilson, you know, earlier on we talked
but
about.
Yeah, it's like Big Show's dad had died several years previous, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, what year did Andre die?
Don't go there. That being said, it's not some sort of Melanie Pillman type scummy or anything like that, but it's pretty distasteful. To use a sort of a cancer death, and it's still almost sort of pass aside the whole paternity thing in the old you're a nasty bastard and your mama said so stuff. You put that to one side as best you can, but
because you like it.
But the dragging the coffin through the cemetery and with Big Show clinging on. the scummiest thing in the world, no, but still distasteful.
It's distasteful, it's shit, yeah. And does it need to be on a wrestling show? Can't you think of another way to build a match?
So now does he think it's okay to exploit someone's death if it happened years ago?
I wouldn't be shocked if there were no conversation between Vince and Big Show saying, right, when did your dad die? How long ago was it? Was it something else? Something like that I can't imagine even occurred to me. He probably just went up to Paul White and said, we're looking at a storyline. Yeah. This is
your
what we're going to go for.
Yeah.
And, this is what we're going to play out.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't have any knowledge of whether his dad was dead or alive anyway.
No, absolutely not.
Do you have a problem doing it? No.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Can you hold? How long can you hold on to the casket for?
Can you casket, sir?
Yeah.
And let's face it, the boss man was coming off the killing the dog and feeding it to someone, so...
Bad News Gertner from TPWW says, one word, Oklahoma. Russo and Ferrara mocking Jim Ross's Bell's palsy was horrible. It came off as 2 12-year-olds being mean. But those 2 12-year-olds are in their late 30s. It was unnecessary and mean.
Well, Vince Russo is a piece of shit. Forgot to mention this, when we did the Monday Night Wars, I think the last one, the quarter four of 97, was that Oklahoma playing Jim Ross in the advert for the I think it was like Rock'em Sock'em Robots or something like that.
Oh, Ferrara?
Yeah. Was it Ferrara doing?
I can't know.
Was it Ferrara doing? I think it was. I'm pretty sure that was the first time Ferrara did it, and that's probably where Vinnie Roux got the genius idea later down in the years to do it.
I've got no recollection of
probably because you skipped the.
Oh, I totally did. I totally skipped the Karate Fighters stuff.
Karate Fighters. Sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, really?
Anytime you're preying on disability to try and get a personal dig in on someone on the other side,
that's
you're an arsehole.
That's the thing, and not to defend it, but it would be bad enough if it was actually building to something, storyline wise. It would still be incredibly scummy and distasteful. And they're building to that. It's a terrible thing to do, but they're building to that. It wasn't even building to anything. It was just a vindictive, nasty thing to have Ferrara do for the pair of them to get their jollies off.
Yeah, I mean, at least with a lot of stuff that's been commented on or will be commented on, whilst awful in terms of what they're doing, at least you can kind of get on this very basic stance of what they were trying to achieve with it. Like, it had a purpose. As Carl was saying, this was just it was just to take the piss out of someone who used to be employed in WCW, who's now on the other side, who's basically better at his job than any of those fuckwits ever would be in theirs. And it's just it's immaturity. It's very kind of schoolyard. We can't kind of take the piss out of him in any other way, so we'll just pick on the most obvious thing that we can do. It's look, he wears glasses, specky, whatever. It's along that lines of puerile, just pathetic nature, and just kind of shows literally how deep in the toilet Vince Russo licks.
Couldn't agree more. However, he's not the only toilet licker. Kira from TPWW says, wrestling wise, I'd say Vince mocking JR's Bell's palsy on Raw with a beer star poster visible in the background just proves this company does not give a shit about the causes they promote. Do you remember that? Vince doing the fucking Jim Ross impression backstage with a hat on and scrunching up his face as well. Oh, it's fucking awful. I'll show you the picture afterwards.
I bet you that's his party piece. Just the continuing embarrassment, the hobby, I would describe, of Vince McMahon to just ritually humiliate this great guy.
That's it. It's a personal pastime for Vince. There are a litany of examples we could give.
I think he's got a photo album.
Where Vince has used and abused JR, and Liam mentioned one there. You've also got the Nurse Heine, if anyone remembers that one.
That was it. No, it was
Dr. Heine.
Nurse Slobbernock.
Nurse Slobbernock. And that was, after the man's gone in for surgery, they do that to him.
Legitimately life-threatening.
Yeah. This wasn't some... this was a really necessary medical procedure. This wasn't some optional thing that JR decided to have. It wasn't like he thought, I don't like the mole on my arm, I'm going to have it removed. This was something that needed to be done.
Was that the angle? Sorry, Carl. Was that the angle where they were pulling stuff out of his ass?
Yeah, that's the one. Oh,
okay. And then they pulled his head out because that was the line that Vince would always say privately to the people. Always got his head up his ass. Again, personal bullshit.
Yeah.
Pot calling kettle.
Well, I suppose it falls into that line with JR allowed them to do some of these, but you got the kissing Vince's ass in Oklahoma, having Steve Austin beat him up in Oklahoma. Notice a theme here, folks. But then you've got one that really didn't sit well with me, and it and it almost seems churlish for it to be one that really offends me, but it was after they've brought him back on commentary briefly, and Laurinaitis, and I think it's because Laurinaitis is involved in part why I hate it so much, and they decide that they're not going to tell him anything that they're going to do. They call him into the ring and sort of quote-unquote fire him.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Call him nothing but a high-seed redneck and tell him he's fired.
And he just walks out the ring, didn't he?
He tips his hat to Lawler, walks out. That's bad enough. Did you ever see the video they then put on WWE.com?
No.
It's, you don't see the person's face, you just hear the voice as the camera follows him. Do you think you're replaced because of, I think there's something along the lines of, do you think you're replaced because of the way you look, or, you know,
does it
bother you that you're replaced because Laurinaitis is better in talent relations than you were? And you think, JR literally just no-selling it and just walks out. It's, you know, just one of those where I look and think, oh, so sad.
The Condor from TPWW says, how has no one mentioned Steph turning the 9/11 attacks into a diatribe against the US government for going after her father during the steroid scandal? And Dwayne the Lou Skunt from WrestlingForum.com says, Steph's 9/11 promo, then everything else. Scummy or just bad judgment? I guess a little bit of both.
You're actually going to have to refresh my memory on this one. I'm drawing a bit of a blank.
So basically, this is on the SmackDown where they did the kind of memorial. They just had the Alliance and the WWF do random matches. Very much a tribute show kind of a vibe in the air. And they did the backstage
stuff. Is this the sort of the talking head?
The talking head backstage. This is where you got Bradshaw saying we're going to turn your country into a parking lot and stuff like that. Really good stuff. And then fucking Stephanie just talked about how she kind of, I don't want to misquote her, but it was something on the lines of she knows what it feels like because way back when the government were coming after her family trying to tear them apart. And it's like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, it's almost typical. You call it typical McMahon behaviour, wouldn't you? Really, at the end of the day, it's ironic though. Now that you sort of refresh my memory, that some of the more salient points that, you know, were in good taste actually came from Canadians doing the talking head bits. Where I think Lance Storm and Edge possibly one of those talked about, you know, the idea of leaving their family and flying over and all that sort of thing. Talked about, you know, such trivial things almost, you know. And then you have something like this happen, it puts it in a really stark contrast, and they, you know, talk a little bit about family. Yeah, there's no salient points like that. And then you get Bradshaw and Stephanie. And you think,
That's probably what she was thinking. That's probably was their mindset, to so sort of self-involved, living their own little bubble. And mentality of as sickening as that is.
Loss from Pro Wrestling Only has a series of them here. We were talking about Jim Ross previously. Hey everyone, remember that time they booked Triple H versus Jim Ross on Raw so Triple H could rough him up and actually permanently injure his eye legitimately as a receipt for lowballing him on a pay-per-view payoff a few years earlier? The story was that Ross was specifically told to stay low on the payoff and not budge with Triple H, but then when Triple H went to Vince said, oh, I can't believe he did this, we'll take care of it. Which actually, they've done plenty of times.
Vince would never do anything like that,
yeah,
just ask JJ
Dillon. Yeah. Savage was the one, right?
Yeah.
Where he stiffed him on the WrestleMania 7 payoff, and Savage was furious after Vince was the one that gave Dillon the number. And then when Savage goes to Vince and says, what the fuck's up with this? Vince says, oh, this is a JJ Dillon issue, I'll fix this for you. And just puts the heat all on Dillon for his own decision.
That's where you have a head of talent relations to be
the bad guy.
Fall guy, yeah.
Bad cop, good cop. It's there. JR being led to the slaughter on Raw is pretty horrific, isn't it? Again, just get some shots in on JR and have some fun.
It's fucking bullshit. That's all it is.
It's totally bullshit.
It's bullshit.
That thing of, sticking the guy out of his element in there to... More from Lost and Pro Wrestling Only here. Again, these are quick fire. Hey, everyone. Remember that time management knew that Bob Orton had hepatitis and kept it private, then he bled all over The Undertaker?
If I remember rightly, that one didn't go down too well with the dead man.
No, it did not. And Bob Orton was not seen for quite some time after that was discovered, if I recall correctly. Loss also says, hey everyone, remember they did the Austin Benoit match on Raw from Calgary with Stu Hart at ringside and reenacted the Montreal screw job right to his face while Bruce Hart picked up his dad's hand and forced him to wave at the camera? Fucking Bruce!
Didn't Smith Hart also have a sign that was derogatory to
Brett,
if I remember
rightly?
Of course
he did, because they basically kidnapped Stu in his home and drove him there while Brett didn't want him. It's just like, you fucking idiots.
One more. Have we got more stuff on Bruce?
No, unfortunately.
No? Get to work, people. Bruce can't get away with just that one.
Hey everyone, remember when WCW had Ric Flair fake a heart attack on Nitro to draw a rating?
wasn't it the heart attack that then became poisoning by Bischoff?
Yeah, of course. Very similar ailments, I understand.
And that was probably one of the better uses of Ric Flair in WCW during that period. which tells you what you need to know.
Obviously a fan of world class on the booking crew at that time, so.
Yeah, Matt Dorgs from F4W, just to shift this once more, says, and this is the one that I voted for at the Christmas show, didn't Dave Meltzer report that Vince and those in charge likely knew that Chris Benoit killed his family and still aired the tribute show anyway? If true, that has to take the cake.
Now, hold on a sec, so is that just a rumour, or is that actually so been confirmed?
I can give a little bit of insight on this, because I actually asked Dave Meltzer specifically this question once. So the deal was, and this has been documented other places too, but the gist of it was that about, I think it was 2 to 2.5 hours before that tribute show, Carl DeMarco told Dave Meltzer that that's what happened, and Carl DeMarco, who, by the way, is the WWF president of Canada at the time, WWE Canada president, whatever, he's the one that told the authorities to tell the parents. He got on the phone to the parents. He navigated. He got Scott Zur, who was an Edmonton journalist, to go to the house to talk to the parents and kind of calm them down. If they know 2.5 hours in advance, the way that Meltzer was told it in an email I got from him was that the company was told this is what happened. It's not speculative. This is what's happened. If Dave Meltzer and Carl DeMarco know, Vince McMahon has to know. I don't see how there's any doubt about that at all.
Absolutely.
How much he micromanages that company?
Well, the thing is as well, and you're absolutely right, he must have known. There's no man alive who can convince me that Vince wouldn't have known that if Carl DeMarco did. Even if you put that to one side, the events leading up to it, you know, the text messages, all those sorts of things, I don't want to misquote them, so I won't go sort of word for word on them, but it was along the lines of sending out these random text, people telling me lovely, like Chavo Guerrero had some strange text back.
Chavo and Scott Armstrong.
About the back door is unlocked and all that sort of thing.
Go outside, door is open, the dogs are in the enclosed pool yard. My physical address is this.
Yeah, you know, that's enough to make you, you know, automatically sort of jolt back and think, something's not right here. Let's hold off on any sort of tribute show or anything like that until we know everything. So even if Carl DeMarco didn't know that, and Vince didn't know what had happened, the events leading up to it would make you think, something's not quite right here, let's just use a bit of discretion.
You err on the side of caution in
absolutely
a case like this. Some people have made the case they found out halfway through, because that's when it broke nationally.
Yeah.
And if you watch the show back, the difference in the images they use of Benoit is quite interesting, because at the start it's all smiley, memorial, in memory of, and then at the end of the show it's very kind of, to be quite honest, cold, chilling picture of Benoit. And as the show goes on, they use pictures of the family. As it's going on, they change the images in the corner of In Memory Of. It was just Benoit on his own at first, and then it was the family. It was a fucking weird deal anyway. This is one of those things where, depending on how much you want to use that heat of the moment, don't know what's going on argument we talked about with Owen, to me this one's different, because if they were told up front, this is what happened, 2.5 hours in advance, And made that call. That's the scummiest for me.
But even with the timeline, like I say, if I want to go back to the messages again, because they were coming through on the Sunday.
Sunday morning at 3 a.m.
Sunday morning at 3 a.m. So, you know.
Actually, no, sorry.
No, then again on Saturday as well. When they get
Saturday night, Sunday morning.
Yeah. Saturday night, Sunday morning.
Saturday
and,
as well.
And, you know, they knew he wasn't going to be at the show on Sunday. So they already knew there were suspicious circumstances, you know, over 24 hours in advance. So, again, for that reason, I don't think that Vince could use as a defence to sort of the heat of the moment or the fluid situation that you had with Owen Hart.
They knew there were problems because Benoit had missed his flight, but the deal is that Chavo apparently didn't tell anybody about the messages until Monday morning.
What a fucking idiot!
In fairness, he got them at like 3 in the morning, so his story was that he remembers looking at the message, but he didn't really think anything of it, because it was just a weird message. Benoit had just recently moved house, so when it was a message concerning my physical addresses, he probably just thought, you know, because no one thinks that, do they, that that's what that's going to be.
Yeah.
Knowing the guy and what he'd text you normally when he was fucked up on whatever he's fucked up on.
Yeah.
So what are people taking as scummy from
the fact, the idea that Vince McMahon knowingly put a tribute show together knowing he was a child murderer? Almost in the vein.
Why would you do that, though? I mean, why?
I have no idea.
This is trying to get in depth with this fucking guy's mind. I mean, I'll tell you what, I've never actually seen the show. I didn't get a chance to see it, so I don't. But yeah, if we take as correct by what's being reported, that they must have known before the show's going on, then in Vince's mindset, like, why did he go ahead with it? Was it because he thought, like, maybe thinking, like, he wasn't getting the whole truth or something? Like, maybe think, like, well, okay, maybe that's what they're thinking at the moment, but maybe, like, something else might come out. Did he think, like, maybe, like, let's continue on, hopefully this might not get, like, blown up or anything, like, you know what I mean? Like, maybe it's not get commented on, maybe we can just, like, duck our heads and avoid everything? Or maybe he thought, like, if we don't acknowledge it in any way, shape, or form, maybe that makes us look guilty for associating, not guilty of the crime, but, you know, that's what, like, make them look bad for associating. So, like, if we put out something now, we kind of keep our heads up and just be like, well, we didn't know he was this bad, so this is a surprise for us. Whilst if they didn't put a show on straight away, they're like, yeah, we're kind of not surprised by this.
I see what you mean. It's, it would arouse suspicions.
That's it.
Something, yeah, like this allows them almost to try and stay above the fray as best they can.
Well, that's, yeah, the thing. When you're looking at these scummiest things, I think I'm looking at how do they exploit something for a personal gain. And if it's that it was a damage limitation attempt to play naive, because we'll do what we always do with our memorial shows and what we've done before, yeah, that's shit. Can totally see a communication issue being, you know, we're going to do this show, how do we handle it? And they handle it poorly, because you've got to do something.
And as well, just to back up what you're saying there, Kieran, if it wasn't public knowledge yet, I'm sure they were trying to figure out how Johns are going to be if we're the, yeah, ones that break the news, because it hadn't come out anywhere yet. And by the time that show hit the air, it wasn't out yet that it was a murder-suicide.
And then maybe they're ready, and as it's ongoing, that's when they change up, when the story breaks. Yeah. How do you handle it? If that's you, how do you handle it? If you know that's gone on.
I think you have to treat it like a news story. I think you have to do what they did, very much in the sense of Michael. I mean,
how much shit would they got then? Yeah, but then we'd be here doing the same podcast saying they use it as a ratings ploy,
yeah,
as a news story. How do you handle the situation?
What you're saying is it's almost no win, right?
It's no win, and they're almost handling it with the softest gloves they could, yeah, do. I bet the whole production, yeah, I'm sure the whole production crew didn't know the whole story.
Oh, no, of course not.
So that's when you get in. Yeah. So they're trying to do a soft kid gloves thing because you've got to address it in some way. And not all elements are on board in the same direction, because they can't do it, because if everyone knew, then the story would have broken even sooner. It's a real... I'd like to hear an example, an idea of how anyone else would have handled it.
The idea of dedicating a show to this breaking news story, again, I can see your point at the same time of they're not the most delicate company when it comes to dealing with death, as we saw with Melanie Pillman. So are 3 hours of this... Because it was a three-hour show, too. So it was like 3 hours of... We're going to talk about this massive story, and, you know, these are the details. As we know, more's coming in. We've got an update. Like, how do you do that? Like, well, yeah, you can't put the wrestlers on talking about the show. You can't. How do you stretch that over 3 hours? As counts as I sound, well, saying this from a TV perspective, well, they are, yeah, having to run this show.
The only thing you can possibly do is, because God knows they'd have had enough stock footage. You could obviously
last week's
you
Raw
could obviously announce the death of Benoit, and you just go for, you know, in light of this, there is no live show tonight, here's a best of Raw. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be Benoit. You can just throw any old shit out there, basically.
Come back every so often with an update, something,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and just a cut in, say, anyone who is expecting a live Raw tonight, you're being treated to the best of Raw, given the unfortunate circumstances with Chris, yeah, Benoit. That may possibly, as GLE alluded to, sort of arouse suspicions of them, you know, why aren't they addressing this? So it's they were, you know, boxed into a corner, and you are damned if you do, damned if you don't. But would we look back as negatively on the company if they'd have just done, as much as it would have aroused suspicions at the time, looking back now, would people be so negative on the company if they'd just run a best of Raw and not acknowledged it in as much detail, as opposed to a tribute show, whilst knowing full well by that point what had happened?
No, I think you're right, actually. That would have been the best thing to do. So then the discussion is, are they scummy for not cancelling it and going ahead, or was it just a bad error in judgement?
Because I didn't see it. Did they do a similar thing with, like, Eddie Guerrero, where they pre-recorded a lot of stuff with the superstars, like, talking about
him? The wrestlers talking about him, yeah.
because that's a thing where you're juggling it yourself, where that's where we're talking about the amoral aspect of this, yeah. is because
the guys didn't know, but Vince,
if Vince did and went ahead with it, then the real kind of part of the amoral thing is him showing that footage of people talking about Chris Benoit when they don't know what the real situation is. So now, their words have now been, you know, documented, whatever, as saying this about Chris Benoit when they don't know the whole situation.
Yeah. At the same time, is that scummy or is it error in judgment and the lack of communication, and I think
that's probably what it is. It's obviously not. Vince isn't thinking, you know what, let's get these fuckers to tape something because they're like dickheads. He obviously doesn't want to do that.
Yeah.
It's just the situation you're in at that given point in time.
I guess also the fact that as soon as Raw finished, how quickly they separated themselves from it. They've never showed that Raw again, and just the way that the policy of the company completely shifted. Disbanded from Chris Benoit kind of shows that it wasn't. I don't think it was a scummy move, because they, as soon as they kind of really saw where how much shit was on the fan, they just completely moved.
That's murky line, and you're going to say the same thing where, oh, okay, now that the world realizes that it's shit, now you're going to do it. But when people, when people had the question, you were all for glorifying the guy, even though you knew it yourself.
Yeah, because people were looking. So you were trying to pull the wool over our eyes. You were trying to, you were leading us down the old primrose path when really you've known this all along, and you're only reacting to it now because, you know, people are outside the tent pissing in.
Yeah, and again, we're saying all of this on the assumption that they did know, and the reason this basic argument is happening is because of Dave Meltzer saying the line, I've seen him say it, it will be denied until the end of time, but they had to know, and this is why, and gave the timeline of events. I think he wrote on the Wrestling Classics message board as well. He sent it to me. I asked him about the timeline that he knew and stuff like that, and that's what he said.
How many different voices did Vince have at that time for him to make that uninformed or informed, just, whatever, decision?
This one is it's so speculative, though, because if you do know the full extent of what he's done, no fucking way.
Why would you do that?
You wouldn't fucking
do that. If you knew it, it seems so stupid to do it.
I don't know. That's why I'm just...
That's where there's a little bit of murkiness there. Yeah. What is not murky, Eric, is the aftermath. As we all know, WWE's never been too great in the aftermath of deaths, and they weren't here either. Burnside from F4WWE says, WWE's press release blaming the Benoit murder-suicide on Daniel Benoit having Fragile X syndrome, which would have been reprehensible even if he had it. So yeah, this is Jerry McDivitt in his panic fire, accusing a syndrome that there's no medical record that he actually had, for family tension that we've now discovered was a source of consternation within the family.
The strain on the family and insinuating that this helped sort of...
It's not drugs! Don't look at drugs!
The notion this sort of, giving the impression that this was the straw that broke the camel's back. It's typical sleazy Jerry McDivitt.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of the words to accurately convey just how disgusting that is.
They try to switch the genesis of what happened here to being not that there was something wrong with Benoit due to medication,
basically,
whatever, but that it was his son had some made up illness that made him snap.
Much stress on the family. Basically, G, they didn't have Benoit's wife to do a Melanie Pillman, so that concocted a cover story change direction themselves.
This is a fairly decent candidate for one of the scummiest things ever. Yeah.
But I remember hearing that, and for a long time, like thinking that, like that their son had some sort of mental issues. Like if their intent was to try and like, don't look over here, look at here, it didn't work because it just made everything just feel so much worse. You just put poor petrol on the fire. That's all.
It's like the emailer alluded to, even if Daniel Benoit did have those issues, it would be scummy to bring that into the public domain. Even if that was part of the marital problems, it would be scummy even then.
Yeah.
The fact that it's absolute bullshit just makes it 10 times worse.
Yeah, again, there's always that air of question because there are reports that that Daniel was going to like a nursery type of thing, or he was being involved in a nursery, like something that you would do for younger kids. And he was 7 years old, and there was like there was kind of a bit of a question mark at the time. Maybe he's being held back or whatever. But all this stuff is so speculative that to even with these questions in the air at any point to throw that out there and say this was It was trying to make a loud noise.
Even then, it would be at best incredibly irresponsible.
Yeah. Although this wasn't written in, actually, just sparked my memory of one of the knock-on effects of this whole horrible fucking tragedy was that the Vince McMahon death angle. A candidate for scummy moment that nobody actually voted for, it just reminded me, was Ixnay completely. But that's got to rank up there with these guys doing the fake tributes and stuff like that, and putting pictures of fans putting flowers at the Titan Towers and putting the flag at half mast because Vince had died, shit like that. And these are the fans that like fucking went to Ready to Rumble and like thought it was good. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like this is like the lowest.
Shame on them.
It's like I don't know how anybody could go for that angle. That was horrific. It was horrible at the time. It looked worse when Sherry Martel died, and it sure didn't look good after any of this anyway. So. Getting to a couple of not necessarily lighter ones, but certainly ones that don't have as much depth to them in terms of discussion. Adam Bomb 87 from F4W says, Paul Heyman getting cheaper flights for talent by telling the airlines the wrestlers were going to funerals for immediate family members just to get bereavement fares is pretty crummy.
We all remember Ron Simmons' bar mitzvah.
I just immediately think of that promo that Paul Heyman does when he was having his
job evaluation.
I'm a promoter, you know, I'll do whatever it takes so I can live another day, you know. It's just like it's that shady area of business, but compared to what we just talked about.
It's not as if he's using actual deaths.
He would have owed RVD a hell of a lot more if he hadn't got those cheap flights at the end.
So. If anything, it was more laugh at the air flights, really. You know, the airplane companies just like, you dumbasses.
Jushin Muta Liger from Pro Wrestling Only says, Jim Neidhart dressing up as a Klansman and beating up Virgil. No matter if you like or dislike Virgil, any person who's flicking the channel would automatically think a KKK member is beating up a black man in a wrestling ring. This was an angle. Do you remember? You seen this, Carl?
I don't remember this at all.
It's a shitty angle from some random indie company that got TV in 1995, where like it's Virgil versus the Thug, and he's dressed in a fucking KKK outfit, pretty much, and just beats the shit out of Virgil. It's just not cool, gentlemen. There's a lot of other racism things that we're going to talk about over this series, unfortunately.
Funny.
Mr. BTY from F4W says, that time Shawn Michaels desecrated the Canadian flag. For shame, Mr. Michaels.
It's fucking hilarious.
What, the humping the flag?
No, I think it's sticking up his nose.
Sticking up his nose. He humped it at Survivor Series.
Oh, yeah.
Stuck on the crap.
What was that? Oh, who said that? Well, they said that's why
Brett
says that's why they hate you. It's not because you screwed me. It was because you humped the fucking flag.
Yeah,
beforehand.
Well, you know, Shawn humps the flag and everyone loses their fucking shit. Brett's humping everyone in the locker room and gets a clear pass because he's good on his Brett.
Not members of the active, not females on the active roster, just rats.
Hey, the spur of the moment, doing something heelish, and it worked because it got heat. I've never been one for people who get offended when stuff is done to people's flags. It's a fucking flag with colours on it, you bellends.
Can you imagine if someone unscripted decided that to the American flag, Vince would fucking hit the ring and blow his quads again. He'd be out there in a shot. We'll get to one more here while we still have the time. Wyatt Sheepmask from the UK Fan Forum says, it's hard to top the whole Muhammad Hassan arc. While they tried to dress it up as character being American all along and it was in fact prejudice of the audience, there was no way you could fall for what was really going on. The fact that the character was around for 6 or 7 months before being sent to hell via the stage floor at, where else, the Great American Bash is alarming. What happened then? TNA signed Daivari, give him the same gimmick, and give him theme music that starts with an aeroplane crashing. Do you remember that? The Sheikh Abdul Bashir period of his career when his music started with the catchy riff of an airplane crashing into a building.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah. TNA needs to be fucking raked over the coals at some point during this series. AVM from the UK Fan Forum also says, I'd probably go with running with the Hassan attack on The Undertaker, where Hassan, accompanied by people dressed as Islamic terrorists, choked out The Undertaker with piano wire, and it aired the same day as 7-7, although it was taped before. Given the jingoistic attitude towards Murica and their war on terror that WWE had at the time, you'd have expected them to be able to edit out that segment on such a poignant day for one of WWE's largest international markets. And Maluko from TPWW says they had successfully built up this really layered character who was a heel, but was justified in his frustration at what he perceived to be the mistreatment of Muslim people post 9/11. It is still topical today and was really interesting, and I was intrigued to see where he might go as a character. Then, out of nowhere, he basically orders a bunch of hooded terrorists to the ring to get The Undertaker, going for cheap shock value and basically saying, yeah, I'm exactly what I was protesting against a few weeks ago. It was horribly poor taste and robbed us of a really interesting character and personality.
Well, he did always do the old slit throat to whoever the person was who's putting the camel clutch on, and I don't mean the old Undertaker thumb across the throat yourself to signal the end. He used to do it with the finger across that person's throat, and he did that from the first day he was in the company. So his overtures were always there. It didn't come completely out of nowhere. But on this subject, because this one does get my goat up, because we can talk about WrestleMania 7 and whether or not, as part of the build, we were really tuned into what that was all about. By the time this angle airs, we're all old enough. We know exactly what's happened. I would say this blasé notion that because it happened here, do you know what I mean?
Because they're outside of the realm of why they would understand why it affects us more directly than them.
Yes,
yeah, because what was the reaction? Obviously, I'm guessing the reaction from our side of things obviously wasn't very good. Hence, what happened afterwards. What was the reaction from the American side of the audience with that angle?
Well, UPN fucking pretty much demanded they get rid of the character, which is why Hassan was written off the way he was.
So in terms of because also with the other stuff that you mentioned with Hassan and both what Carl was saying as well. So what part would you put as being, the bad part? Would you just say was it the entire character full stop, or just how far they went with it?
Both, I think.
You think both?
I remember reading the results, and this is obviously before it happened, and I'm just looking at this, a bunch of fucking mass terrorists hit the ring and choked him out with piano wire and then carried Daivari out in a crucifix position. This is how you know what you're doing with this angle. The idea of Ted DiBiase. Yeah.
I'll say this just for clarification as well. Even if 7/7, the London bombings, if they hadn't have happened, this would still be disgusting and still shouldn't have made air. Still shouldn't have been greenlit.
I think the thousands of American soldiers and other forces dying in ongoing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq anyway, even to this day. Again, I'd say maybe an ignorance thing. How aware were they in Connecticut of what was happening over here?
Well, they're doing house shows and all this malarkey.
Yes, there's that element. I mean, absolutely, if it was over there, it would get pulled. But, there is the logistical element to it. But the fact is, it was distasteful. Yeah. It's not like you're doing... out of a time frame when it's not a politically sensitive, potentially insightful angle anyway. It's in the middle of it. It's like,
I kind of put this in the same barrel as 91. I don't know whether I would put the character itself at its basic rudimentary description as being completely bad, as in just like a heel, Arab American guy. Because I don't see that at its core any different than say from Rusev right now. It was more just the fact that with Rusev, they didn't overstep the bounds with Rusev.
Well, this is the thing, yeah.
Whilst with Muhammad Hassan, they obviously did, and that's where the issue lies.
They did it from the very off, because one of the things that, again, American listeners may not be aware of, when those initial Hassan vignettes aired, again, Sky Kerm, they didn't make the air, because it ended with the whole praise Allah thing, which Sky was having fucking no part of.
It's completely different. There's the religious element. We've never been at war with Bulgaria, for fuck's sake. And even if it was,
let alone right now.
Let alone right now. And obviously, the connotation is it's a Cold War rollover. So, which happened to then click because the geopolitical situation with Putin and Russia kind of peaked at quite frankly an opportune time for them. It was. They were going to go in that direction anyway. Doing something based out of Cold War ideology to something that's ongoing, politically sensitive, with people dying as the story's playing out, with the religious elements behind it, which is just stoking potential hatred amongst a youthful audience that is susceptible to that ideology. It's a completely different situation.
I understand the point you're trying to make about just the sort of the base of a character, talking about prejudices and that sort of thing.
But
it wasn't just the fact that it was a foreign heel. It was dog whistle stuff. Like I said, they would he was doing the throat slit signal, by which point obviously we don't need to go into how many beheadings there'd been and killings and videotapes of hostages, all that sort of thing. It was all very well. A dog whistle almost suggests somewhat subtle, like. I don't know. I never felt to me like it was that subtle. I always felt, what you're doing. You know exactly what you're implying.
It was a moose in a bathtub on those first promos. Like I said, it's why I couldn't.
When doing the comparison with Rusev, I'm describing it in terms of like the base character, just there being a, just a foreign heel, just a foreign heel, not just
he
not
wasn't
just
foreign,
not just,
American.
Not, yeah, yeah, not just
so
not
some
just
religious
with,
elements,
not, yeah, yeah, not just with the religious element, but just say like just so happens this heel is just so happens to be Arab, same as just Rusev just so happens to be Bulgarian or Russian sympathy, whatever that they're doing. But the difference obviously was, which obviously looks like they did learn their lesson with Hassan, is that they haven't obviously overstepped the mark of Rusev at all, at least as far as I'm concerned. Whilst Hassan, as you said from the very beginning, they did. They took it from just being like, oh, we have a heel who just so happens to be an Arab American. They took it like, no, this is an Arab American heel who's going to be doing this stuff and sprouting this stuff with an actual Arab with him who can actually speak the language. And, that's I kind of put that the Hassan character in the same bucket as the Sergeant Slaughter in 91, because it kind of seems like the same thing in essence in terms of like WWE trying to capitalize on a real kind of war element to it, because that's what the issue was in 91, and it just seems like it was exactly the same thing. It's just weird that they didn't learn that lesson from 91 of like, look, just let's just not have any characters in association with real life war events, but instead they just decided.
And
yeah,
again, I don't
we'll
want to understate
that.
It, but the element of religion is a massive one as well.
I see the difference between the two. The Slaughter one, to me, obviously the time frame,
that's important
skewed.
Too. Isn't
he's
it?
American.
Both,
it's a
well, there, still, like,
still
it's ideology.
But there's a wacky pro wrestling element to it. Sergeant Slaughter, we know what the character is. Okay, whatever. When it's the religious element of Hassan and the context it's being presented in the time frame with what's going on around the world, it's bad news.
We are going to have to call time on this one, unfortunately, although we are by no means out of verbiage and stuff to talk about here, because we have so much. So we are going to revisit this in a few weeks' time and talk about such classy non-scummy things as the treatment of Eddie Guerrero, Trish Stratus barking like a dog, Bruiser Brody and the murder there, New Jack, your favourite wrestler, G. John Chase, Mark Levy in the situation there in IWA Mid-South. We can talk about Rob Black, Ian Rotten, so many more completely scummy people and incidents. So we will revisit this. I hope this podcast has been more insightful than depressing. So far, of the ones we've talked about today, line in the sand, scummiest of the ones we talked about today,
Melanie.
Yeah, what about you, Carl?
It's a tough one between Benoit and Pillman one for me, but I'll probably say Pillman.
I'll just to, I guess, spread the votes, then I'll go for the Daniel Benoit Fragile X, because that's, I mean, yeah, the Vince playing off the death is awful, but when you're trying to like falsely add layers to a child murder to try and protect your own arse, that's a different level.
Of the ones here, I was originally immediately going to join you guys in terms of Melanie, but just talking about the Benoit stuff, which I kind of wanted to talk about for a while, just have a definitive talk about this.
And,
because,
and just for the benefit of the listeners, we have actually, at various points during different podcasts, talked about Benoit, and we've consciously edited it off because it was always such a kind of a low note, it felt like. Anytime we've had like a deep discussion, just because it is what it is, this is the perfect form to talk about, I feel, so we're going to leave that in.
But wasn't there even, is it worth mentioning, there was even a Benoit podcast we did that never made a hit?
Yeah.
Glad that we finally kind of got, because it's a subject matter I think that does deserve being talked about at least once anyway. By this panel, so now I'm kind of like I'm not so sure. My original answer was going to be Melanie, but that Chris Benoit stuff, man, I mean, as I said before in previous podcasts, man, that's for me was the darkest day in wrestling.
Oh, a lot of people would have said the same thing.
That was when you turn around and went, it's not going to be the same again, and like this, no one's going to come out of this smelling the roses. The shit has hit the fan. There isn't actually a fan. The shit's just hit you now. That's it. There's no fan protecting you. So I'm probably going to lean towards Benoit as well.
Alrighty, well, with that said, we are going to, like I said, we're going to come back to this and touch on so many other different scummy moments. If we didn't get to your feedback this week, we will get to it in part two of this series. But because we don't have two depressing shows back to back, we're going to return to the Monday Night War timeline.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to talk about the first 2 months of 1998, January and February. As we mentioned the last time we did a timeline show, we're going to let these breathe a little bit in 1998, because there are so many notes per quarter that we want to bump it down so we can properly give things their just due in terms of time. So we're going to do that next week, January and February, in the Monday Night War timeline for 1998, complete with notes, of course, from the Wrestling Observer newsletters of the time and all the interesting tidbits that comes with that. So, with that said, thank you very much for listening. We will talk to you again next week. For G. John Chase.
Happy to sing.
For Carl Jones.
Buenos dias.
And for Kieran O'Rourke.
I've got Trish barking like a dog on my iPad.
Oh, for fuck's sake. I am Liam O'Rourke and we are Addy. Talk to you next week.